We're having a public hearing on House Bill 5015, Department of Economic Development, Statewide Regional Investment Funds, and Community Assistance. The chair has to leave and attend another meeting, so I'd like to turn the meeting over to Representative Butler if he would be so inclined to run the committee meeting in my absence. Upon the conclusion of my meeting, I shall return, but until then, I think if Representative Butler, you'd be so kind as to run the committee meeting. Mr. Scott, welcome back to the committee. Kelly Friels, Department of Administrative Services. Is there any opening comments that you, either one of you, would like to make?
Mr. Scott, welcome to the
committee. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Bill Scott, Director of the Oregon Economic Development Department. Just to maybe overview what we're going to try to cover today. As you know, on Friday, we started working through the specifics that are in the Community Development Fund, and specifically within the portion of the fund, the category of funding that we call statewide investment funds. You can find the categories on page 2 behind the Community Development Fund tab. Because of the various schedule changes we've had to juggle some of the people that want to testify a little bit. What we plan to cover today is to complete the statewide investment funds category, complete the regional investment funds category, and the community assistance category for sure. So that's what we need to do is make sure we get through those three, and I'll do immediate opportunity if we can. The tomorrow we've scheduled the, in addition to the film and video office, the small and emerging business assistance, and I'll finish the immediate opportunity if we don't get to it today. I'm going to have to skip around just a little in the statewide investment funds today. What I intend to do is first Steve Bryant from the League of Cities wanted to testify, and I wanted to kind of finish up on the infrastructure portion, which is what we were covering on Friday, which is the main thing that Steve is planning to, has asked to speak to. So if you don't mind, unless there are questions from the committee, you could begin with his testimony.
That would be wonderful. Mr. Bryant, Steve Bryant from the City of Albany. Senator, you is recognized.
Steve Bryant is from Albany, and I appreciate his coming to testify before the committee.
Thank you. And I am Steve Bryant. I'm city manager in Albany, past member of the board for the League of Oregon Cities. I started working with the department through the summit group probably almost 2 years ago, where, as you know, a coalition of folks came together to look at how we work with the Economic Development Department and each other to try to leverage the scarce resources that we allocate for this purpose. And one of the first things we did, of course, is take a look at what the needs were across the state. And I bring to you the perspective of cities where we have identified infrastructure as really our top priority. We have critical needs throughout the state in infrastructure funding, particularly sewer and water type needs, as we struggle with the lack of funding that we have for sewer and water facilities. We're charging our customers market rates for sewer and water facilities, but we're dealing with a real absence of resources as we try to meet new state and federal requirements. So I'm just here to say that that coalition, I think, has come together to support this budget. We think it provides a healthy infusion of funding to meet the needs across the state. I think it'll provide flexibility as we look at the needs of regions. I think the whole focus of this budget, where we look at how we as regions can meet the unique needs by coming together rather than having the state kind of take a top-down approach where the regions can take a bottom-up approach and work with each other to identify what the critical needs are in those regions to support community development efforts is a real good move as represented by this bill and by this budget. Imagine, if you will, a business, I can use our own experience in Albany, take our sewer business, if you will. It's an enterprise fund. It operates on its own revenues. It has no support from outside sources other than the occasional state assistance that we receive. It's about a $3 million a year business. Our customers pay essentially market rates for the service that they receive. But we're looking ahead over the next 10 to 15 years at a $90 million need. Of course, we're in the Willamette Valley. We're faced with new environmental requirements. The Endangered Species Act, I think, is going to bring us a whole new set of rules to play by. But imagine that business that generates $3 million a year of income faced with a $90 million need over the next 10 to 15 years. And you quickly understand that in places like the Willamette Valley, we will need new sources of funding, new ways to conduct that business. I think our customers will only be able to stand so much pressure on the price point, that is, the amount that they pay for sewer service. So that's just one example, and that story is repeated throughout the state as people are struggling with the very high cost of infrastructure development and enormous capital needs facing us over the next 10 to 15 years. I think you were presented with the survey of needs from cities around the state. We've identified a little over $1 billion in unfunded infrastructure needs, primarily in sewer and water systems throughout the state of Oregon over the next 5 years. And again, the capacity to fund that just simply isn't there through the user charges. I think we recognize that we've got to step up to the plate and attempt to increase those fees and charges so that we recover most of those costs. But again, the consumer, I think, has a very limited ability to absorb very high rate increases. So I just want to emphasize that we need help. We need flexible help. There are ways that the state can step in through the various pots of money that are available here through the bonding that's proposed in this budget to help communities, particularly smaller communities, deal with these huge unmet needs. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you have from the city's perspective about those needs, about the flexibility that we think exists within this program, and here to answer questions.
Question to the mayor of Albany. Representative Beck is recognized.
I was listening on the radio this morning. There was talk of Wilsonville's water supply problem, which is, I guess, related to some of this to
right.
some extent. And I'm kind of curious as to how cities are integrating their growth management thinking along with their desire for state and federal funds to improve or enhance or expand their water systems. And I guess my concern is, are we setting up funds to encourage cities to grow in irresponsible ways or beyond their capacity, and rather than trying to focus our funds towards communities which have fixed existing infrastructure and deal with lands that encourage infill, livable communities, all this other stuff the governor's promoting. That whole question, I wonder if you can respond to that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Beck, I think it's an excellent question. Many cities in the Valley are in the middle of their periodic review program now, where I think we're taking a look at that very question. Again, I can speak in terms of Albany, where 5 years ago, I would say Albany was a community that you'd have to label as pro-growth. We were lots of, we came out of a recession. There were lots of loss of timber jobs and very strong emphasis on economic development and trying to attract new industry. Today, that attitude has shifted because people have seen, you know, very rapid growth, and they've seen the impacts of traffic congestion and facility shortages. We don't have the water supply problem that Wilsonville has, but we have other problems. And so sort of the attitude has shifted that we need to be more in a mode of responsible growth and taking a look at where we want to target growth and how we want to grow. And I think it's absolutely critical that we find ways to integrate our infrastructure planning with this whole notion of how we responsibly grow. I think programs like the TGM program through ODOT and DLCD, this program where we have to integrate infrastructure planning on a sort of a sub-regional basis to take a look at regions and what their needs are. In some cases, it's replacing aging systems. We have portions of our sewer and water system that are 70, 80 years old that are falling apart. In other communities, it's a need to build new water treatment facilities just to be able to handle growth that makes sense. But I don't think we have any problems at all at needing to ensure that these programs are integrated with our land use goals and the sound planning principles that I think we all support. Efforts like the Willamette Valley Livability Forum, I think, are really critical to this effort, where we look at integrating infrastructure development with growth management. So it's a very legitimate concern. I think by having these sub-regions form to look at these issues, I think you'll gain more consensus about where we ought to target these investments, not just to handle growth, but to manage growth and to redirect growth. It all makes a lot of sense, and I think we can do that with this program.
Follow-up. Thank you very much. Senator Yee, recommend.
Thank you. Steve, does your work group have anything to do with reducing housing rehabilitation funds by 60% and add a lot of state mandates and make it difficult for applicants to apply?
The Summit Group has not dealt with that question. They're more focused on the infrastructure programs, and we've not been asked to look at the housing rehab portion of the program.
Another question.
Certainly, follow up for you.
So the infrastructure, are they focused in increasing jobs so that it makes it possible to attract new industries, or the infrastructure is focused more on health needs?
When the group initially started, we were really kind of focused on economic development, and we quickly realized as we were dealing with ports, we were dealing with counties and cities and different areas of the state, that it's not economic development per se that we're after, it's community development. In some parts of the state, there isn't a high need for more economic development because the economy is pretty healthy in much of the state. In other parts of the state, the economy is suffering, and they need infrastructure to be able to accommodate new industrial development. But by taking the sort of the sub-regional approach, we recognize that there are places like in Wilsonville or Albany that it might be better to target the money towards livability type things rather than economic development, that we need to work at making our communities better places to live, not just bigger places. So that's why I talk about the importance of flexibility. We need to make sure that these funds can be used in ways that make sense within each region, not just to promote more growth. That's not the purpose of the program as we see it now. It's community development, not economic development. And so we changed the name to reflect that.
Well, don't you think, Steve, the two are interrelated? If a community is depressed, high unemployment, high alcohol and drug use, or high domestic violence and child abuse related to high unemployment, then there's no quality of life. So I believe the two are interrelated. And since this economic development, granting the funds, shouldn't that be the highest priority?
Again, Mr. Chair and Senator Yee, I guess I would agree that that has to be a very high priority, and it's certainly true that as we make these investments, you're going to improve employment situations. The other problems that you talked about are things that could be targeted within a community given the flexible guidelines of this program. So I think, yes, it does do that.
Thank you. Are there other questions for Mayor Bryant? Thank you very much, Mayor Bryant. May I just ask, what is your current sewer rate in the city of Albany?
We've been averaging rate increases over the last 5 years of 5 to 10%, and that looks like that's going to continue for the next 5 years. Well, right now, I would say the average residential sewer rate, we bill quarterly, and it's running about $55 to $60 a quarter. I think that's going to increase, as I say, anywhere from 5 to 10% a year for the next 5 years.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And bonding, what will the bonding do to that rate, you think?
Well, I can't say how much the city of Albany would benefit from the statewide bonding. We're looking at having to do some of our own bonding, but it'll have a minor impact on that. I think what these bonds would do is give us the ability to apply for targeted pots of money to do specific projects. It could help us reduce those rates slightly if we were successful in receiving some of those funds, but it's not going to have a huge effect.
Thank you very much. Let's see, do we want to, is there some specific order that you'd like to go down the list,
Mr. Chair, I just want to say Steve Bryant is city manager. Not mayor. Mayor has a white beard.
Oh, okay. Well, he certainly doesn't have a white beard. I beg your pardon. Thank you very much for that clarification. I appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman,
are you the mayor?
I fit the description, I guess. Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to maybe kind of point out a little bit where we are. As far as I know, that covers everybody that wants to testify on the kind of the general sewer and water infrastructure portion of this, at least, which would be, if you look on page 4 of your pages behind the Community Development Fund, where the different programs are laid out, the water, wastewater, special public works, safe drinking water. We've already spoken, I think, some to community facilities, and I don't think there's any testimony that addresses the brownfields, which I think I described before as intended to pilot a program authorized by the previous legislature that was actually initiated by a task force that we, I guess, had convened at the request of the Associated Oregon Industries, which is to create a small revolving loan fund to make loans for assessment of a contaminated site for redevelopment. We will have some testimony on the Marine Navigation Improvement Fund from Mike Thorne, who's going to be here a little later this morning. But I think you might ask if anybody else wanted to testify to any of these statewide investment issues, and if not, we can go on to the regional investments.
Let's start off with those that are from over 100 miles away. We have Wes Hare from City of LaGrande coming from over 100 miles. And then we have, Nikki Whitty from Tuesday, from over 100 miles, and certainly Judge MacArthur from Sherman, that is from over 100 miles away. So if none of those folks need to testify what's relative to the water and sewer and wastewater portion, can we just proceed then with your order of business that you have then to go next to the Special Public Works?
Well, we were going to visit to the Regional Investment Fund, okay, and the Rural Investment Fund, I believe, both, okay, Judge MacArthur and Commissioner Whitty are here to testify on those along with a couple of other people.
Okay, good. We'll go ahead with those folks then on the relative to the Regional Investment Fund.
Maybe I should just refresh the committee's memory briefly on what the regional investment fund or the regional investments are. The interim work group reviewed the whole array of resources that are available from the state, and I guess revalidated the idea that a significant portion of those resources should be available not at the state's judgment about what's the right project to fund, but at the regional level, and therefore recommended I guess I would say, reinvigorating the what was used to be called regional strategies. And as you know, you've passed legislation to modify and rename that program the Regional Investment Fund. So what's in this category, $20,600,000, is within the Commission's preliminary investment plan, the portion of the funds that the Commission proposes to allocate to the two statutory programs, the Regional Investment Fund and the Rural Investment Fund. Those are both will be the plans, regional development plans will be prepared by either regional strategy boards or regional partnerships where they exist and have chosen to take on that function, and those plans need to be approved, if it's a regional strategies board, by the Economic Development Commission. Then individual projects are actually funded in accordance with those plans by the regional boards or regional partnerships. So, and the difference between them now with the change in the legislation is essentially the two funds are exactly the same in terms of the broad discretion about what kinds of investments they can be used for. The difference is that regional investment funds are available statewide, although we distribute those on a formula that we adopt by rule, which biases the funding heavily in favor of areas of economic distress, low unemployment, etc., which tends to favor the rural areas. The Rural Investment Fund, of course, is not available inside the boundaries, the urban growth boundaries of the designated metropolitan counties, or within the cities in the metropolitan areas and the major metropolitan counties.
Okay, could we have Judge Clauser and Commissioner Nicky Betty?
Yes,
certainly. Senator, you
Mr. Scott, what kind of criteria the regions we use in granting the funds? Is this a loan that is getting applied for?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Yee, the legislature has authorized, has given, I guess, a very broad discretion to the regions to develop a strategy for development that is supposed to be related to the region's findings about what its development needs are. Then the criteria that are used are up to the region based on its own plan, which will have been approved by the state. So those criteria can vary, and in the past have varied around the state. In the past, the regional strategies boards tended to have a very strong bias toward job creation as a criteria. I think that has, for the reasons that Steve Bryant probably just articulated very well in response to Representative Beck's questions, I think those have become more varied in recent years, and some boards are more specifically focused on incomes rather than jobs or other, you know, sort of other specific aspects of their economy. And under the new program that you've adopted, they won't even be required to focus on the economic aspect of livability in their community, but may focus on any aspect of where they think their community needs to develop.
Follow up, Mary Lou.
If the department is required to provide us information about how money is spent, the success or performance of the program, we still need to have those information. Job creation, what does it cost per job, the return on investment, and the advantage to the community. And we are, we'd like to know that will still be the focus of these grants and loans.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Yee, we can find for you the language in the statute. I think the statutory authorization and our rules will still require, number one, we will have a copy of their plan so we'll know what their criteria are, and if there's no regional partnership in place, those plans will have to be approved by the Economic Development Commission. And then secondly, they will be required to report against those on results just as they do now, and we've provided all that information to you. We'll still be able to do that. I think it's just that I think comparison is going to get harder because we've gone further and further away from a, if you will, a one-size-fits-all or a single kind of statewide goal for what we think they should be trying to achieve, and we'll be more having them tell us what they're trying to achieve. So I think it will maybe be a little more demanding on us and on you to assimilate that information.
I think the, Mr. Chairman, the idea is they need to be accountable for the spending of the money, and we need to be accountable to us for the information, because we are all accountable to the public on the wise spending of funds.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator Yee. Okay, Judge MacArthur and Commissioner Whitty.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Mike MacArthur. I'm a county judge in Chemung County. I'm also president of the Association of Counties. I was also a member of the work group on economic development during the last interim, and represented the counties in that capacity. I'm here today to speak about the regional programs, the elements of the community development funds that are available for local regions for their economic development programs. I think this concept goes back to the Goldschmidt administration, as I understand it, and the idea was to build and nurture grassroots efforts to improve local quality of life, and of course that included jobs and job creation and better economies. I think the basic concept that I'd like to get across this morning about regional programs is it's a bottoms-up approach. If you're really going to have genuine community development anywhere, it has to start from local communities, and they have to decide what it is they want. And what these funds do is they attempt to put resources in the hands of those that have developed the local plans, strategic plans that are developed by local citizens. These funds provide opportunities to initiate new ideas in communities, to provide gap financing, leverage other funds. I think the department probably has the statistics, but I think these regional funds probably leverage more other dollars than any of the other funds invested, and they help build local capacity. In order for people to pursue new ideas or to pursue the grant funding that's available in the infrastructure programs, it's necessary to have local capacity, people at the local level who are able to work on those projects. These funds, I think, are especially targeted to help those not sharing in the state's prosperity. It's, Bill Scott said, the formulas are designed to favor those areas most rural and distressed. They're also designed to assist local businesses and also coordinate the different efforts going on around economic development, education, workforce, and growth management. The program statutes, as you've heard, have been rewritten to reflect the work group's new directions report and the new concepts of integration of housing, environmental quality, transportation, economic development. This coalition that helped rewrite the statutes included the cities, counties, courts, people from the governor's staff, and legislators. This new structure and the provisions in the new structure provide for this integration, I think, will lead to much smarter investments than took place in the past, not investments made in isolation. The economy of the state is certainly shifting. In some places, what we need is job replacement or creation of jobs. In other places, what we need is economic development diversification. And yet others, we need growth management tools. I think these funds provide opportunities to deal with all those problems. You've heard about flexibility. And that's the key point, I think, about these funds, is they provide the local flexibility. I think one of the interesting statistics that I've heard about is that most new jobs are created by companies that employ 25 or fewer people. So the idea is how you create a climate that allows those companies to flourish. There's also statistics that show that small businesses have a greater chance of succeeding if they're located in a community with a strong economy. So it's chicken and the egg sort of problem. I call it economic gravity. If you don't have it, you don't attract it. what these funds do is provide needed capital to get businesses started. They provide technical assistance. They can provide training, workforce development, and the regional programs can target the help to the community as it's needed. The problems may be finding workers for jobs or increasing job opportunities. In either case, these programs can help solve those problems. They're flexible enough to meet local needs, but another key hallmark of these programs is the decisions are made locally by groups of citizens appointed by local commissioners representing cities, counties, the business community, local tribes, and other elements of the community that are involved there. And the accountability is built into this process. Plans are reviewed by the commission. The measurements are in the plans. And then reporting is done on how the funds were allocated and to the degree to which the plans were complied with and how the benchmarks were met. Of all the economic development programs, this is the one most valued by counties. That I'll conclude and be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions for Judge McArthur relative to the issues dealing with regional investment funds? Mr. Whitty?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For many years before I became a commissioner last January, I managed these programs, formerly known as Regional Strategies and the Rural Investment Fund, for the Coos, Curry, and Douglas County region and their Regional Strategies Board. And getting to where we are today has been kind of a long and involved process, but I think the benefits are going to be good for individual regions as well as meeting the individual needs of the counties involved. Senator Yee, our region is kind of like yours. Some of the communities are along Interstate 5. They have that benefit, and others have transportation and other barriers by being over on the coast. But because of the high unemployment in our region, I think Douglas County would probably want to put emphasis on developing industrial parks. Curry County, because they have no industrial land, would probably want small business tourism enhancements. In Coos County, building upon a strong partnership we've developed with Western Douglas, would probably want to put most of our emphasis on business recruitment and retention activities. I like the idea of mandating that the regions have their two-year action plans with projects identified in that plan, because in the past, our region has had some general guidelines, but without having those plans in advance, every funding cycle, we have three times as many requests as we have money to fill. Our region has a number of ports, and we place strong emphasis on the ports. We've been able to help them diversify a little bit because of the lessening of our traditional fishing season. We've helped them build industrial buildings, retail commercial centers, and these. We provide our money as matching funds, and we've been really fortunate over the last several years. We've had a program called the Northwest Economic Adjustment Initiative, and those were some federal dollars to help timber-dependent communities. And, for example, one of our projects, we used $35,000 of rural investment fund money for to do a business incubator project, and the total cost of that project was over $800,000. Also, the retail commercial building at the Port of Brookings Harbor, I think our initial investment was $19,000, and there was just a little bit more, but it was well over $1 million project. So we feel good about that, and I urge your support for this and other programs that are included in this bill.
Can I just ask a question about your business incubator project at $600,000, Commissioner Woody? How was it funded, and how has the success of that been at this particular point?
It's been, we realized early on that in order for it to be successful in our area, we couldn't have any debt. We also are fortunate that we found a dilapidated building that's within a city-owned airport district, so the building is not on the property tax rolls. But it was funded through Rural Development Services, formerly Farmers Home, and the U.S. Department of Commerce primarily. We have six individual work days of about 1,400 square feet each, and then two quite larger ones.
And they're all filled with this particular...
Well, the two larger ones aren't. We just finished putting in heat and electricity in those two big ones. But one is 4,500 square feet, so it presents a real good opportunity. And once that big bay is rented, it should be completely self-supporting. It's almost there now.
Now, are these new businesses or are these spin-off businesses from existing businesses?
They're new startup businesses. And in the beginning, we said that no business would be allowed to stay in there more than 3 years, but the National Incubator Association has said you really shouldn't have that clause because some businesses mature a lot more quickly than others. And so we're trying to take a look at 3 years and see how they're doing.
I see. And there is no debt associated with the $800,000 the other funds that were received to bring your facility up to par were grant funds then. And finally, relative to the Business Incubator Program, when the county, even though this is off the tax rolls at present, when the county goes ahead and develops that, and then leases that back out, does that bring it onto the tax
roll? No, here's what we did. We made a deal with the two federal agencies that as soon as the grant dollars were approved, that as soon as Coos County took title, they would immediately deed it over to the city of North Bend, which kicks in off the tax rolls.
I see.
Because the purpose, this was a barrier to our development, was that Coos County had no ready-to-go, low-cost space that included training and all the amenities for startup businesses, and so that's why we developed the project. And if you have to pay a mortgage payment and if you have to pay property taxes, you can't get the rents down low enough to what those businesses can pay.
And final question, with regard to the $800,000 investment, what do you feel will be the total amount of the number of jobs that will be provided when the incubator is up and running at full steam all of the days in?
Well, you mean over time or immediately as the business just goes in?
Yeah,
I think each one of the businesses, of course, it's created an entrepreneurial opportunity for the owner. And I think just about everyone that's in there now has created at least two jobs. And there's a real strong partnership formed with the college. So these businesses learn about business management and accounting and how to treat their employees. And it's been something we've needed for a long time.
Excellent. So with total of six plus two, you have 8 days potentially.
Right, but the other two are quite large, and so hopefully we can probably have, with some additional parking coming from the city of North Bend, we could probably have, oh gosh, I don't know, maybe 30 people in each day, depending on the business that's right there.
There's potential that for $800,000 you could have 80 jobs approximately in the full facility. Then.
And roll those over time after time.
After the 3 years or whatever the maturity time would be. Thank you. That sounds like an excellent opportunity. Any other questions for Commissioner Liddy? Senator Dean's recognized.
Just to follow up the same line of thought, you keep track of the job creation.
Mm-hmm.
We have return on investment.
Our first criteria for spending any of these dollars has been that it either directly creates a job or it leads to the creation of job. And there some infrastructure projects. One of the communities, I think it was Myrtle Creek, needed to expand a sewer line, and if they could do that, or a water line, I can't remember, but they'd be able to open up quite a bit more land for industrial use. So we track as an indirect benefit the jobs that are created by the businesses that we're able to site on their property.
So you keep a good record and report that.
The grant recipients have to respond to us every quarter with a status report of what's happened the last 3 months.
That's run by the county, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Good. Excellent. Other questions for either representative or for Commissioner Whitty or for Judge MacArthur? Thank you very kindly. We appreciate you being with us today. Any further testimony relative to the Rural Investment Fund portion of the Economic Development Program Department?
Mr. Chair, I'm aware of at least a couple of people who are here, Craig Osterman from the Secondary Wood Products Association and Terry Westland from the Lane County Convention and Visitor Bureau, and there could be others. I'm not sure. I think the committee members will remember the regional strategy program or regional investment program was originally conceived as an industry-specific program with industry-specific strategies. I think in the course of remodeling the program, the industry associations have been eager to be sure that while we open it up to other kinds of projects, that the successes that that approach has brought us don't get lost in the way the program is run.
Okay, in addition to Mr. Craig Osterman, the second person was
Terry Westland.
Okay, Terry Westland. Okay, if they'd like to come forward. Welcome. Go ahead and state your name for the record, if you would, please.
I'm Terry Westland. I am employed as the president and CEO of the Convention of Visitors Association of Lane County, Oregon. I also serve as the board president for the Oregon Association of Convention and Visitors Bureau. And relative to the topic this morning, I sit on the Lane Economic Committee, which is the local committee in Lane County that works with all of the communities on the projects that they bring forward for this program. I'm relatively new to Oregon. I've been here about 3 years, and this program has been very intriguing to me as I've sat on that committee and looked at the variety of projects that come forward. And I would have to say that, in my opinion, the model has been very effective. It certainly doesn't go as far as to fund all projects that are out there, as you've heard from people testifying earlier. But I think what it does is it provides enough hope and enough of a catalyst that it gets people talking within their communities in a very organized way about the projects that need to take place, facilitates discussions about growth, about jobs, about some of the things that you've mentioned, and causes communities within themselves to reevaluate on an annual basis what their priorities are for projects, and then also provides a catalyst for communities to work together within the county and regional structure. I have found that people's perceptions, not only within their communities, but what's going on in a little bit larger context within their regions, has really been enhanced by this program. I also would encourage you to continue to provide incentives or catalysts for regions to come together and work on multi-regional projects. There have been several in the state that have sort of come out of this program. In relative to my industry, I've certainly seen a lot of tourism-related projects come forward, but as you've discussed earlier today, I think that there are several different layers that communities look at, and in some cases they're ready to do very industry-specific projects, and in other cases they're not because they don't have some of the basic infrastructure in place that they need in order to provide basic sewer and water hookups. And whatever the case might be, I think it's been effective for people at the local level to make those determinations as opposed to someone at the state level having to come in and make those priority decisions for people who really are capable of doing that themselves and appreciate the opportunity to do that. So I strongly endorse the program, encourage your full support of it. Be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you very much, Ms. Westland. Are there questions of Ms. Westland? Senator Yee is recognized.
Thank you. Ms. Westland, what kind of multi-regional project do you have in mind?
Well, Lane County is a good example of this because when we were talking about regional strategies, we were lumped with several other counties as part of a region. Now Lane is kind of floating on its own, and yet there are still corridors that are shared and issues that are shared because we have, as you know, a county that stretches from the coast to the Cascade Mountains. And we have issues that are sometimes closely aligned on the coast with counties to the north and south of us. And along the I-5 corridor, there are sometimes issues that are aligned with counties to the north and south of us. So it's sometimes difficult for a region to stay totally focused within itself when its geography, if it's a sub-regional project on the coast, it may be something that we need to work with counties to the north or south. And sometimes there are projects that come into line. The scenic coast byway system is one where we were certainly working with counties to the north and south. We didn't necessarily use funding from this project, but it's conceivable that something could come up, whether it's an interpretive project that serves visitors and residents along that corridor, or it's a basic infrastructure project that is providing sewer and water services from an area that's in Lane County but closer to Yahats, which is in the next county north. There may be times when you need to be able to work together between regions.
Okay,
certainly follow up.
What kind of incentive do you have in mind?
Well, I'm not as familiar with the history of the program, but I think that historically there has been encouragement of multi-regional meetings and cooperation on projects. I really don't have specifics to cite for you.
Maybe we could ask that question of Mr. Scott when he comes back up, too. That would probably be appropriate because that is a good question that needs to be responded to. Thank you very much. Maybe we could hear now from Mr. Osterman.
Mr. Chairman, committee, good morning. My name is Craig Hosterman, and I'm the director of the Secondary Wood Products Training System. This program is a partnership of the Oregon Economic Development Department, Central Oregon, and the Ben Lynn Lane Lincoln Regional Strategies, which are the public sector, and Lane, Lynn Benton, and Central Oregon Community Colleges, the education sector, and the Secondary Wood Products Companies, as well as the Northwest Wood Products Association, which is the industry sector. The program was launched in April of 1995. The grant was funded by contributions of $100,000 from each of the regional strategies, plus $653,000 from OEDD Regional Strategies Multi-Regional Fund, $50,000 from NWPA, which was formerly WPCC, $111,000 from private businesses, and $647,300 of in-kind contributions. As originally conceived, the program was to deliver three levels of training to the secondary wood products industry. Entry-level training was to bring new hires up to certain requirements of safety and ability to handle elementary equipment on the floor. Tailored training would provide courses presently available through the community colleges, hopefully to improve performance, communication skills between employees. And then finally, the specialized training would provide process-specific and developed by the grant people for delivery. All of these courses were to be subsidized at 70% of the cost of the course. Measurable outcomes for the three types of training were 12 courses with 240 employees trained at the entry level, 18 courses with 180 employees trained at the specialized level, and 50 courses with 250 employees trained for tailored training. The required total of 80 courses has been accomplished and exceeded. To date, there have been 127 courses conducted. Likewise, the number of employees to be trained, 670, presently stands at 2,147 employees trained from over 200 companies. The private funds and in-kind contributions are in line with or exceeding the grant requirements. The original needs assessment provided the basis for this program. The continuing needs of the secondary wood products industry have, if anything, increased since the program began 4 years ago. The transition that is taking place is a shift from primary wood production to the more value-added wood products. At one time in history, 1 million board feet of raw lumber created one job. In the secondary or value-added wood product industry, that same 1 million board feet can create as many as 24 jobs. This industry exists all over the state of Oregon and is providing essential jobs in many rural communities still hurting from the loss of primary wood production. The increased profit potential of value-added has not been lost on the international community. This is resulting in a significant increase in imports, which are impacting our economy. With the known differential in wage rates that exist between our workers and those outside our boundaries, improved efficiency and more highly skilled workers are critical for the industry to remain competitive. Secondary Wood Products Training System has successfully shown how a partnership of public, private, and educational organizations can positively impact the training needs of the industry. The program has been operational in the 7-county area included in the 2 regional strategy groups. The training needs of the secondary wood products industry do exist all over the state. The success of this present model should provide assurance that an expansion in delivery to a statewide level can be achieved and be very beneficial. The present grant funds are depleted now to a level that will not allow for an expansion in delivery to the additional areas within the state. If additional funds are not forthcoming, present funds will only be sufficient to conduct a small number of additional courses and to create a repository for a few of the course materials. One of the outcomes of the grant was to be self-sustainability. That's a nice concept and gets included in most grant applications. The reality is that education has always needed supplementary funding in order to continue. The Secondary Wood Products training system is no different. It has shown, however, that it can deliver its products efficiently and economically to the benefit of the industry it was created to serve. With additional resources, it can expand and continue to provide its customers with even more of the skills required to remain competitive and strong. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hosterman. Perhaps you could share that I'm from that portion of Oregon, the county in which I reside. When we think of wood products, we think of juniper and sagebrush, but throughout my district with Harney and Lake County and portions of Klamath, we do have some wood products, including some additional juniper. Maybe you could give me some feel, if you would, please, of some of the secondary wood products that you're talking about when you talk about your secondary wood products training system.
Secondary wood products would be, you know, the furniture we're looking at, the moldings around windows, doors, pretty much. We've included anything that's kind of past the primary stage, although we've not included particle board or plywood, some of these things. But pretty much we've gone through any kind of wood value added that's available.
So really we're not talking about the plywood portion, which would normally be associated with chips and so forth, such as what is one of the items being considered with juniper, but you would be talking about value added as your secondary level of not just producing the board feet of lumber, but producing actually the flitches or the various pieces of molding and those kinds of things, which create
the more highly skilled value added type products. And juniper is, there's several companies that are working quite extensively to bring juniper into the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
It's a strange wood as far as how to handle it, but it is handleable, if that's a word. And there's plenty of it growing out there, and I think people would like to find a really good use for it.
I'm sure that we would, because in large measure, I think that a lot of the agriculturists feel like it's more of a weed and a debris wood than it is a true wood product.
Yeah, I understand it uses a lot of groundwater too to keep it going.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for that clarification. Are there questions then of Mr. Hosterman relative to the secondary wood products training system? Very informative. Thank you very much, Mr. Hosterman. Others that would like to testify relative to the regional investment funds and or rural investment funds or formerly the regional strategies issues? Bill, Mr. Scott, I wonder if you could help with the questions, at least this one that I had come up with, and Senator Yee and others, but relative to the regional strategies as we convert it to the regional investment funds. First of all, we've changed our regional strategies overall formula, our regional investment funds formulas of where the boundaries are, and have given more latitude, I understand, to the actual regions themselves. How are the monies being appropriated, how does that compare with the former regional strategies in relationship to the regional investment funds? I'd like to have just a brief explanation of that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just maybe the simplest answer I can give would be that the method for selecting regions or configuring counties into regions essentially remains the same under the statute, except that if there is a regional partnership in place that can essentially supplant the traditional
system by which the, in either case, it's essentially driven by the counties themselves, and the department may have a role if the counties can't agree on what the configuration should be. In terms of the actual distribution of the funds, that is done by rule. We don't anticipate a dramatic difference in the way it's done, with the exception that we've already committed to make sure that all of the funds flow in such a way that we calculate all the factors, unemployment or income or poverty or so on a county by county basis, so that it won't affect the county's decision as to how it wants to be configured regionally, whereas previously we had that had been a factor for some people.
The reduction from $21,300,000 down to $20,600,000, an approximate $700,000 reduction relative to those total funds that were available previously under the regional investments or regional strategies program with the rural investment fund. The reason for that $700,000 shift?
Mr. Chairman, that was essentially what we were, the Economic Development Commission in its preliminary plan was trying to achieve restoration or essential restoration of those funds, and I think the challenge was just to juggle the different competing demands, and my understanding is that the Summit partners agreed that the $20,600,000 meets that criterion.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Scott relative to the regional investment funds, which would include the rural investment funds portion of the budget?
Mr. Chairman, I believe Senator Yee had a question about the multi-region and specifically what Ms. Westland was raising there, and Mr. Hosterman actually also spoke to that in his testimony. Basically, the statute previously permitted the governor or the department to withhold up to 25% of the funds to earmark it for multi-region projects, and then we solicited proposals for multi-region projects, and they had to bring some of their own regional money with them, and they had to be sponsored by one of the regional strategy boards, or I think two of the regional strategy boards in the different regions. I think everybody agrees that some version of that should continue, but some of the local government partners were uncomfortable with the Economic Development Commission having sort of the absolute power to just decide how much. So what the new statute provides is it authorizes that there be a multi-region strategy mechanism that's to be adopted by rule by the commission and can be implemented only if it's agreed to by the Summit partners. But we don't know what that will be. What we've discussed is a mechanism by which a certain amount of the central fund, if you would be set aside to match on a more equal basis, I guess you would say, some of the regional initiatives.
Senator Yee?
Bill, what kind of example do you have for multi-regional projects? I know Ms. Westland mentioned scenic bypass ways. Is that a transportation issue?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Yee, I think in situations where regional strategy funds have been used for scenic byway type projects, it's normally been the marketing piece that would be funded by the regional strategies program. Mr. Hosterman gave a great example, and a rather typical example, which is a workforce development project that is Lynn Benton Community College, Lane Community College, and Central Oregon Community College have collaborated on an integrated, comprehensive set of curriculum for the secondary value-added wood products industry.
And I would say most of the multi-region projects have tended to be either workforce development projects of that kind or marketing projects where they will tend to, particularly in tourism, market a, like an Eastern Oregon piece or the one of the ones that's gotten a lot of attention recently is the tribal tourism project that involved a number of the Indian tribes in the state. There's also been some research projects that have been funded that way, both in agriculture and then just in developing industry industry statistics. You would also be familiar, I think, with the rural gas station project, which is a multi-region project to match funds that were also available in environmental quality for helping remediate the rural gas stations do their tank cleanups.
Thank you very much. Are there other questions of Mr. Scott relative to the second of the three functions that we'll discuss today on community development fund, the regional investment funds? If not, sir, could we move in under the community assistance fund?
I think what we better do, kind of given the segue, is to go back to statewide investments to pick up two things where there are people who want to testify here. One is the two ports items, which is the Ports Revolving Fund and the Marine Navigation Improvement Fund. The other is that Tim Martinez from the Bankers Association wants to speak to the business finance program. Maybe we can knock that one off first because it's very brief and you aren't being asked to, or the commission isn't planning to provide any funds to those programs. But I could briefly, I think we have provided you information before. I think we run five different business finance programs that one way or another assist banks to provide capital to companies. Essentially, those programs are self-funding. That is, every one of them isn't self-funding, but we now have legislation that allows us to transfer balances from the Oregon Business Development Fund to the other program. The Oregon Business Development Fund actually makes quite a bit of money, so it generates positive cash flow that can then be transferred, for instance, to the Capital Access Program, which even net uses money because it keeps buying loan insurance and has no replenishing mechanism. But those are the programs. And if Mr. Martinez spoke to that, then I think you could follow that immediately with Mr. Armstrong from the Public Ports Association and Mr. Thorne from Port of Portland is here to speak on the Columbia Channel Deepening Project.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator, you're recognized.
I have a constituent who is here to testify on the Community Development Block Grant Program. He's from more than 50 miles away. Is it time to call upon him today?
We could certainly do that. I have two others. Let's see.
Benjamin from Brownsville.
Okay. And we do have Mr. Wes Hare here from LeGrand as well. So,
and Mr. Hare, I think we had maybe had one other person to testify on those are in connection with the community assistance
programs.
Yeah. So that's what we got to get through.
Money. Right. And let's go ahead with the three that have been named, and then your witness that has come from more than 50 miles.
Yes, Brownsville is more than 50 miles.
And Senator Yee, the name of your?
Vanderlip.
Vanderlip.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Tim Martinez, Oregon Bankers Association. I'll be brief. I know you have a full agenda before the session starts at 10. Oregon banks have enjoyed a very long and productive relationship with the Oregon Economic Development Department, and I'm here today on behalf of our 54 banks in the state urging support of House Bill 5015. I wanted to take just a minute or two to talk about two programs in particular. First of all, the Capital Access Program that was established back in 1991. We were one of the first states to do that. It's designed to increase the availability of small are bank loans to small businesses, providing loan portfolio insurance that allows us to make loans carrying higher than conventional risks. The department has established a loan loss reserve account for each participating lender. And when a loan is made, the department, the lender, and the borrower each pay a percentage of the loan amount into that account, which can be drawn upon to cover any losses for defaults or defaults. We find it to be very flexible and very user-friendly. It's only a one-page application. In our industry, that's very rare. Usually anybody here who's borrowed from a bank knows we usually want pages and pages and usually have you sign document after document. So we find this to be very easy, and there is even a 1 or 2 day turnaround for most applications. So that, again, we appreciate that from the department. It's proven to be very popular with Oregon banks. In the past 8 years since it's been in existence, more than half of our member banks have participated in the capital access programs from throughout the state, and I believe the department has provided you with a breakdown of that, and I'd be happy to answer any questions on that as well. Through the end of last year, almost 1,500 loans were made for a loan volume of about $56 million. As I said, they've been made throughout the state, all types of business activities from forestry, farming, fishing, tourism, wholesale, retail, you name it, it's pretty much been part of our loan program. Small businesses borrowers believe they've created or saved more than 2,000 jobs around the state because of this program, and almost a third of the loans, 31% of loans have been made to startup businesses. So again, we're very proud of that. The next session in 1993, the legislature established a companion program, the Credit Enhancement Program. The program focuses on small, non-retail Oregon businesses that trade in national and international markets. The department provides guarantees for the loans, which are made by banks and other lenders. They cannot exceed $500,000 for 15 years in length. Similar to the Capital Access Program, this program as well is user-friendly. Minimum of paperwork and that terrible word, bureaucratic detail. We currently have more than 40 banks involved in this program. Since April of 1994, the department has approved 122 guarantees for loans around the state, which totaled $27 million. They've ranged in size from $15,000 to $1.7 million, and about 15% of them have been made in distressed areas. Claims against the guarantees have been minimal, only about 2% overall. And through this program, borrowing entities believe they have created or saved about 650 Oregon jobs. Again, we view both of these programs as illustrations of a public-private partnership at its best. We continue to believe that most jobs in Oregon are created by small business, and these programs help those, and would be happy to answer any questions.
Relative to the jobs that have been saved or created, 650 jobs from the 40 banks, and the numbers of loans that are coming out, are these interest rates quite favorable interest rates, Tim?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes, they are very favorable. I defer to the department, but I believe they're slightly below market.
Okay. And so these are in some way through the program subsidized through the guarantee fund, is that right?
Correct. Yeah, they're higher risk. They allow us to make higher risk loans, Mr. Chairman.
And the only 2% default at this point?
Correct.
Are there other questions for Mr. Martinez? Representative Schrader is recognized.
Mr. Martinez, looking at the amount to capitalize that particular portion of statewide investment budget. We've only got $250,000 in there right now. It used to be $1 million item almost. That doesn't seem adequate to do the range of investments you're currently involved in. Is that accurate, or is there a different number we need to have in there?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Schrader, I believe I heard Mr. Scott just say prior to my coming to the podium that they were not seeking additional funds in this area. We certainly believe on the commercial side there's more that can be done, but would follow their lead on what they believe is an appropriate number.
When you say to follow the lead, I assume that you're
that you could do more if you had more that are willing to cut back, because that would be somewhat of a cutback in the amount of small business funding that you'd be able to do with these high-risk and startup businesses?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that that's necessarily true, because we've built up a reserve account over time as well, so I don't think that's necessarily accurate.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much. Other questions of Mr. Martinez? Senator Lynn is recognized.
It's a capital asset program. As you mentioned, it's under the market rate, but as I've seen in the past, it seems like over the market rate. And I wouldn't use the money because it's a higher interest rate plus a cost. I'm not sure whether actually it's under the market or above the market rate.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lynn, again, I would apologize for not having as much information as I probably should on this issue. There are some additional fees that are involved with the program. That's true.
Representative Schrader, did you have a follow-up? Representative Schrader?
Just to kind of follow up on Senator Lynn's question. So I think the advantage of these particular programs is these are opportunities, and you can't get money from conventional banking arrangements. The advantage of all three of these programs is that they reach out in many different ways and will back not just entrepreneurs, but existing small businesses that are the heart of many small communities when they get out there on some of these big projects, and the cash flow gets a little off or whatever, but they've got a proven track record in these communities. This is an extremely important program, I think, for small businesses to stay competitive in this rapidly changing environment we have. I think this is one of the best mix and match programs. It's basically a private program, which is really nice, and we're just helping leverage the private money and the working for cooperatively with the banking community. So I think it really is a big cost savings and keeps people working and keeps small businesses going.
Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up. For example, the Bank of Astoria, which most would think is a fairly small bank in the state, is made the second highest number of loans, 283 loans. So it's working very well throughout the state.
Thank you very much, Mr. Martinez. Appreciate it. And then we have also to speak to these issues, Mr. Armstrong and Thorne. Is that right?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ken Armstrong, Executive Director of the Oregon Public Courts Association. I've been asked this morning to talk a little bit about the Community Development Fund and the interests of Oregon's public courts in the various funding programs that are contained within the Community Development Fund. In doing that, I think it's important to take a little bit different approach than some of the previous speakers have done. I think members of the committee understand very well the role of cities, the role of counties, and are certainly becoming acquainted with the role of the Economic Development Department in these things. But what I think often is not understood as well, with the exception of some members on the committee, is the role of the public courts in the state of Oregon. And so I'd like to spend just a little bit of time talking about that to lay some groundwork and give you perspective on our interest in the programs. Oregon's 23 public courts play an important role in the rural and urban job creation efforts through the provision of both transportation and economic development infrastructure. I'm going to spend most of my time today talking about the economic development, the community development infrastructure element. First, I think it's very important to understand what ports are and how they serve their communities. And ports can generally be categorized in two different ways, coastal ports and river ports. Coastal ports activities include deep draft shipping, public marinas, commercial and recreational fishing, tourism, airports, boat repair, commercial and industrial property development. For the Columbia River ports, activities include deep draft shipping, inland barging, commercial and industrial property development, public marinas, general aviation and international airports, shipyards, and recreational facilities. I want to take just a second to emphasize the systemic nature of the river ports as part of a national transportation corridor. That's upriver barging in support of exports through the Port of Portland. Mr. Mike Thorne, director of the Port of Portland, is going to be following me, talking in more detail about that, but I do want to emphasize that the Port of Portland, or the Columbia River, serves as the largest wheat corridor in the United States and serves as the second largest grain corridor in the world. And you must understand that ports are the foundation of that transportation system. Now, it's probably worthwhile for me to set the stage a little bit by drawing your attention to some of the findings that previous legislatures have made relative to ports. I'm going to read a couple of them to you because I think they're important in emphasizing, and they give you a good perspective on our interest in the funding programs. Ports of this state are directly and actively involved in creating and carrying out at the local level the economic development objectives and programs of the state of Oregon. And further, development and improvement of port facilities suitable for use in world maritime trade at the ports of Umatilla, Morrow, Arlington, the Dalles, Hood River, and Cascade Locks, and the development of deep water port facilities at Astoria, Coos Bay, Newport, Portland, and St. Helens is declared to be a state economic goal of high priority. All agencies of the state of Oregon are directed to assist in promptly achieving the creation of such facilities by assisting the ports involved with available financial assistance or services when necessary. I'm not going to read through the various tools and powers that ports have at their disposal. You can read that as well as I. But I do want to draw your attention to a couple of specific points, first being the first bullet, that purchasing, owning, leasing, and selling property to stimulate job creation and economic development is one of our powers, and that includes water, sewer, roads, power, and other incidental development activities, as well as farther down, constructing and maintaining jetties, piers, wharves, docks, warehouses, power plants, transmission lines, freight handling facilities, processing facilities, industrial parks, and other facilities. Now, the Economic Development Department's new directions, which I believe you're familiar with, has four goals attached to it, four priorities that were developed throughout this past interim, including support for communities that have been left out of Oregon's economic boom, helping companies that are starting up, doing business in Oregon to compete more globally, ensuring that economic strategies reinforce long-term prosperity and livability, and that partnering with other community growth and development interests occurs. The message that I want to leave with you today about ports is twofold. Public ports are the ideal organizational unit to bridge the gap between statewide goals and implementation of community priorities and projects. And secondly, ports serve to connect public investment with private sector investment to create jobs. Now, please bear in mind the priorities of the new directions, and I think you'll find that they perfectly describe the mission and the abilities of the public ports. Let me tell you a little bit about the specific program interests within the Community Development Fund that the Oregon Public Ports Association has. First is the Oregon Port Revolving Fund. This is a loan fund. They're secured loans for up to $700,000. It cannot exceed $2 million in outstanding loans, and the interest is not less than 5%, with some exceptions, 1% loans, and they're funded through legislative appropriation. Secondly, a port planning and marketing fund that provides grants in the amount of up to $25,000. It does require a local match from the port, and it's for planning and marketing projects such as site redevelopment plans, marketing analysis, etc. That program is funded through the interest earned on the Oregon Port Revolving Fund. And third, and again, Mr. Thorne will talk a little bit more about the Marine Navigation Improvement Fund, but that provides a non-federal match for federally authorized studies and construction of channel dredging and deepening projects. That, too, is funded through a legislative appropriation. The other programs that I won't identify in any detail, but ones that are of important supports, include the Regional Investment Fund, the Water Fund, Special Public Works, Safe Drinking Water Revolving Loan Fund through Senate Bill 403 before this legislature, Brownfield Redevelopment Loan Fund, and I neglected to put on that list, but should be added to Rural Investment Fund. The point I want to emphasize about these programs relative to ports is the interconnectedness of those programs. They all work together to accomplish the mission and the goals of ports, which is job creation and stimulating economic development. I'm going to take a moment as I close out my testimony to give you a fictitional project example. It's a simplistic model that I came up with to give the committee an idea of how these funds work together. Now, you're going to be hearing in the next couple of days some real-world examples of how port projects work in bringing the funds together, but I think this, again, and it is a fictitious example and fairly simplistic, I think it's going to give you an idea of how the various programs can work together. The situation would be this, that XYZ Corporation is considering developing a port-owned site on the lower Columbia River for establishing a widget manufacturing plant that conducts shipping facilities and employs 80 persons. The Port Planning and Marketing Fund provides $10,000 for site development analysis. That can include geotech and some other things through that program. The determination is that the site is adequate to serve the needs of XYZ Corporation. Additionally, a Special Public Works Fund Technical Assistance Grant is made to the city to evaluate water and wastewater needs to serve XYZ Corporation. Now, companion to that, the non-federal share of the Lower Columbia River Channel Deepening from the Marine Navigation Improvement Fund ensures that adequate depth is available to serve the shipping needs of XYZ Corporation. And this is important, at least in this model, due to the need for barging raw material from the Port of Portland ship terminals to the port's site. The Oregon Port Revolving Fund and the Regional Investment Fund contribute to the development of a barge dock, allowing XYZ Corporation to conduct its activities. The company also pays a portion of the dock construction cost, thereby bringing in some of the private leveraged investment. The dock continues to be owned by the port, but is leased by XYZ Corporation. Lease revenues off of the dock cover the debt service on the revolving fund loan. A Special Public Works Fund loan grant is provided to conduct necessary water and sewer line upgrades to serve the XYZ Corporation development, and the water fund provides a loan to the city to upgrade its wastewater treatment plant to accommodate increased system demand from XYZ Corporation. The result here, of course, is that 80 family wage jobs are created in this county, which not only support the local economy, but also contribute to the state through corporate and personal income tax and through property taxes. I think, again, a rudimentary example, but it gives you an idea of how all these programs work together and the role that ports play in accessing each one of those in a very aggressive way to put job creation and economic development investment on the ground. For our part, we are extremely supportive of the Community Development Fund and request by the Economic Development Department. Specifically, we're interested in $45 million into the Community Development Fund for infrastructure programs such as the Revolving Fund, and then also $17.7 million for the Lower Columbia River Channel Deepening Project. Again, you'll be hearing more from specific ports in the next couple of days about some more real-world case studies. I think this gives you an overview of what our interests are in the program, and we certainly come to you today as a supporter and a partner with the Economic Development Department, along with the cities and the counties, in support of the Community Development Fund. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I just had one question relative to your case that you gave us by way of example. In the process of the building of the docks for the private port that would be developed, what would be the contribution percentage-wise, more or less, for the private industry to contribute in relationship to the port itself for the fictional dock that we were talking about? Is it 70-30?
Mr. Chair, there's no set percentage on those kinds of things. It's a negotiated deal. Typically, the private industry is looking for as much leverage as they can get and for public ownership of the facility to leverage the funds. There's no set percentage split, 70-30, 25-75, anything like that. It just depends on a case-by-case basis. Now, the case of the dock, it might be worth remembering that question, Mr. Chair, for Pete Williamson from the Port of St. Helens. That specific example was pulled out from a project the Port of St. Helens did for Dixie Line Lumber, and I don't know off the top of my head what the specific splits were as far as private-public participation, but the message is the same, and you might hold that question for them because they'll be able to give you more detail.
Is the dock treated as publicly owned, therefore not subject to property tax by the county or the city that may be involved?
That's a good question. It is port-owned, but it's leased by the company. Frankly, not being a tax expert, I'm not exactly sure how that works out. So I'm not sure.
but it is used privately then as it's leased by the Port Authority.
Right.
And because it's used privately,
right,
and leased by the Port Authority, it's probably...
Well, owned by the port, leased from the port by the private,
right,
company, that's correct.
Probably subject to property tax based upon what little I know about property tax at this particular point. So
that would be my guess, but Mr. Chair, I'm not totally certain about that.
Thank you very much. Are there other questions?
A good portion of the state of Oregon does not produce grain, does not have coastal or riverfront property. Why would they be interested in supporting the ports in this fund?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, I think Mr. Thorne is going to talk directly to that question, but I think there's no question that through the lower Columbia River, through the Columbia Snake River system as a whole, virtually every county in the state of Oregon has some business that does some shipping through that system, and then also through, of course, the ports of Coos Bay and Newport, although not nearly to the same extent, obviously. There's the case that there are not nearly as many ports in the state of Oregon as there are counties. We have tried over the years to see if we could expand the existence of ports, inland ports, as a mechanism to increase local economic development efforts around the state. So far that hasn't been successful, but we're still hopeful that that's going to be the case. But I think the short answer to your question is that the counties that even don't have ports do recognize and enjoy the benefits of the Columbia River system.
Follow up, all the ports share relatively equally, given the size and nature of their business, in the Port Development Fund?
I'm not exactly sure I understand your question, Representative Schrader, if you might restate that for me.
I'll restate it differently, actually. The total amount of money that is spent in this state on port development and enhancement, is that shared equally with the ocean ports as well as the river ports? Is there a balance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, do you mean access, for example, to the Port Revolving Fund or the Marine Navigation Improvement Fund by geographic area? I think generally that is the case. For example, the most recent project that's been funded through the Marine Navigation Improvement Fund has been the deepening of the Coos Bay Channel. Of course, on the table right now is the deepening of the lower Columbia River. And Newport has had some projects, a breakwater project. There's been some interest in projects up at the Port of Morro for a turning basin, and the Port of Brookings Harbor right now down on the very southern Oregon coast is looking at a surge suppression project. So from the standpoint of the Marine Navigation Improvement Fund, yes, there is geographic distribution. From the standpoint of the Oregon Port Revolving Fund, I can't give you a precise answer to that. I can tell you that ports throughout the state do access the fund. Is it a 50-50 split between the coast and the river? I can't really say that. I'm not sure. The larger ports, quite frankly, are the more active users of that because they typically would have the labor pool, the available property, and other infrastructure in place to make the best utilization of a revolving fund loan. There are a good number of ports that have also used the planning and marketing fund. But it totally depends on what sort of program we're talking about, Representative Schrader. Regional strategies, I think, has been very widely used from all ports around the state, but I can't give you specific percentage breakdowns.
That's a quick question. You testified very clearly this is a huge economic development boom to XYZ town with XYZ port and stuff and has many multiplier effects. This question may not be for you, maybe for Mr. Scott, but it would seem like this is an additional economic strategy that is only available to the port communities and not to communities in the rest of the state. And is that taken into account when they allocate economic development dollars either out of other regional strategies programs or some of the wastewater special project funds?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, I'd be interested in Bill's response to that. I'm not exactly sure how to answer the question.
That's probably more for Bill than for you, so unless you have a great answer.
Well, I won't say that I have a great answer for it. I don't think that it takes away from other investment that would be made in a program such as regional strategies. And the legislature makes a specific decision that it wants to invest a certain amount of money in the Community Development Fund. And then the Economic Development Commission has its responsibility to evaluate where the need is around the state and how much it wants to invest in the revolving fund relative to the Regional Investment Fund or the Water Fund or something like that. I think it's pretty clear that most of the benefit from a project that's leveraged by a port goes to the region in which the port is located. But one of the reasons I read to you some of the legislative findings I did was that the legislature passed has concluded that there is a state interest in making those investments in port communities because it receives the benefit of having stronger rural segments of the state that aren't necessarily within the Portland area, and that just bolsters the Oregon economy overall. So that's kind of a very general, not specific answer to your question, but that's what I can offer.
Thank you very much. Other questions, Senator Yee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Armstrong, the port revolving fund, do you pay back 100% of the loan through the revolving fund, or do you just pay back part of it is subsidized by a logging loan?
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, no, we pay that back in its entirety.
But the benefit...
With interest, yes, thank you.
You pay lower interest because it's a state issue of bond. State issue revenue bond. Is that what it is?
No, it's a direct appropriation into the revolving funds. Typically has been done with lottery dollars. And the port enters into a contractual relationship with the state of Oregon to borrow the money and pay it back over a set term.
Well, you pay back 100%.
Correct.
At a lower rate.
Well, I believe it's 5. It, the statute says no less than 5% interest.
So it is market rate then.
A little bit below, as basically an incentive to use the program, and because there's some public purpose behind it. So I don't suppose you could say that it was truly a market rate loan. It's a little bit below that, but it is a regular market transaction.
And another question.
Certainly. Let's do another follow-up, and then Senator Lynn.
Yes. And then the Marine Navigation Improvement Fund. Do you pay back the loan also?
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, no, that's not a loan. That's a direct appropriation from the legislature to cover the non-federal share of a study or construction project. And there's specific percentage breakdowns for how the Marine Navigation Improvement Fund meets that obligation. But it's not a loan that the port is obligated to pay back.
But what about a $17 million loan?
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, that's not a loan. What we're talking about this session, which I think you're referring, is House Bill 2153, which calls for lottery-backed bonds of several projects, one of which is $17.7 million for the state share of the channel deepening project.
That's not part of the revolving fund.
That is correct. That is correct. And I might say, Mr. Chair, one of the important points there is even though the Marine Navigation Improvement Fund is considered a port program, we don't see it as a program that only benefits ports, but in fact is a statewide program. When you do make an investment, such as the investment of the Lower Columbia River Channel deepening, it's not the Port of Portland per se that's the beneficiary, but it's the state of Oregon through the competitiveness that it continues to provide for this whole region. So it's a state economy project, state transportation infrastructure project, more, in our view anyway, than a specific port project.
And do you keep track of job creation, success of the program, and return on investment data that's required by statute?
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, I have to defer to the department to see what sort of performance measures we have attached to those programs today. I can't answer that off the top of my head.
But this is information required by statute for each program.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We need to ask the department regarding that question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, I think that would be a question for the department if you're referring to the performance measures on the investments through the port programs.
I thought you would know the performance measures.
Not off the top of my head, no. I would have to talk to each individual port based on an individual loan project to find out how many jobs were created as a result of a revolving fund loan. Of course, much more difficult to categorize from the standpoint of the Marine Navigation Improvement Fund. That's not as easily quantifiable.
Thank you very much, Senator. We are running very short on time. We do have some out of town that have come from more than 100 miles. So, Senator Lim, did you have...
Just one quick question.
Thank you.
Let me mention that the Columbia River is the number one in our state for the grain movement, but the second in the world, which is the number one in the world?
My understanding is that the number one in the world is the Mississippi River system. Is that correct?
Thank you. That's what I did.
And we're number one, not just in the state, but number one in the country. In terms of wheat.
Thank you very much, and thank you very kindly, Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you.
I'm going to exercise some prerogative here, and we're going to have to jump around because we do have some folks that are from a long ways out of the area that have come today, and so we will go out of order, and we'll probably just jump straight to the community assistance. I think is that what Mr. Hare from City of LeGrand and Vicki Hilliard.
Mr. Chairman, we're going to have a little trouble making a coherent presentation here. The community assistance line essentially consists of services that we contract for to do downtown development and to do rural leadership training, strategic planning, and project assistance. The two organizations that have been doing that are Oregon Downtown Development and Rural Development Initiatives. Mr. Hare was here to testify, I think, in support of Rural Development Initiatives, or to testify about his experience with that program. Ms. Hilliard is the executive of Oregon Downtown Development. We also have the executive of Rural Development Initiatives, and I think citizen to testify in connection with downtown development. You're not going to have time to do all of those. The two people who can't come back are Mr. Hare and Ms. Hilliard, at least have scheduled some out-of-town travel. So I'd suggest that at least you get Mr. Hare on. We also have Kathy Jaworski here, who's the executive of Rural Development Initiatives, but I think at this point it's really critical to have give Mr. Hare a chance to testify. But we also have Mr. Thorne, of course, on the channel deepening, and then Ms. Hilliard would like to get on today if she could.
I think we may have to jump back to Mr. Thorne on the channel deepening, which is an important portion of the project that we're discussing right now relative to the rural investment funds, but in all fairness, we need to move over to the community assistance, and if we could hear from Ms. Hilliard, Vicki Hilliard, and then from Mr. Russ Hare.
Okay.
Good morning. My name is Vicki Hilliard. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Downtown Development Association. ODDA is a statewide nonprofit that provides tools, processes, connections, and technical assistance to help communities move forward with downtown revitalization. And we provide on and off-site technical assistance, education and training, networking and support, and unique resources to communities. So what we do is help build capacity in Oregon communities to move forward. And this past year, we've worked with 63 communities. We're a very small staffed office, but 85 percent of them were rural and distressed. And so we see a lot of need because communities haven't all prospered. We all know that. And so what we do is try to help communities move forward as best they can. I actually was going to introduce Stacey Graham, who will speak tomorrow for OGDA, so I'm kind of pulling this together. We work in communities as varied as Brookings, Condon, McMinnville, Tillamook, Staten, Lakeview, all over the state. We have great case stories. Stacey will talk more to that later. But we see ourselves as just helping provide support to communities that make their own decisions about how to move forward with downtown revitalization, better livability, just to help give them the tools that they need to do that successfully. And I'll turn it over to Wes.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hedrick.
Good morning. My name is Wes Hare. I'm the city manager in LeGrand. Most of my career as a city manager, as a city official, has been spent in small rural communities here in the state. And for that reason, I have been asked to serve on the boards of Rural Development Initiative. Coincidentally, I also serve on the board of the Oregon Downtown Development Association. I'm here to speak, I think, briefly about thoughtful investment. When I started my career in Oak Ridge, one of the first things that I was greeted with was the closure of a mill that employed about 400 people in a town of 3,500 people, and you can imagine how devastating that was to the community of Oak Ridge. And the only solution that I could come up with as a city manager was, gee, we don't have enough money being invested in this community, and we need more. And I sort of dedicated myself to that proposition. Over time, I was introduced to the state's community initiatives program, and it was being run by the Oregon Economic Development Department at that time. And I was introduced to another piece of that concept. It wasn't just money that we needed. It was also thoughtful investment. We needed a plan. We needed a strategy. We needed capacity building. And the metaphor that I would use to describe the principle is that you can build a 50,000-watt radio transmitter, but if there's nothing there to receive it, nothing good is going to happen. You can load state programs with money, but if there's nothing there in those small communities to make thoughtful use of that money, nothing good is going to happen. And I would testify that organizations like Rural Development Initiatives and the Oregon Downtown Development Association provide the thoughtful piece of the investment strategy. In RDI's case, it spun out into a nonprofit about 7 or 8 years ago, the thinking behind that being that it would leverage in money. Rather than just having state dollars dedicated to rural investment, we would also be able to bring in money from foundations. Kathy Jaworski, the director of RDI, tells me now that 65% of RDI's money is actually leveraged from sources outside the state. That's a really outstanding investment from the state's perspective. By a relatively small amount of money being dedicated to this project, you're getting a great return, not only in terms of dollars, but also in terms of the time and energy of all those volunteers in rural communities who are making things work. From a personal perspective, one specific project that I know of that would not have happened in Oak Ridge, for example, was when the Pope and Talbot Mill shut down in 1989. What was created was a 268-acre wasteland. By virtue of the planning assistance that we received from RDI, some federal dollars, and some local energy, we turned that 268 acres into an industrial park, and today there are 75 people working on that site. That has had a huge impact on that community. Finally, I would just like to thank the Oregon Economic Development Department. I think they've done great work in terms of rural capacity building. In the city of LeGrand, that has resulted because of the partnership with OEDD and with Union County, and recently a location decision by the Oregon Dental Service to locate a claims processing facility in our community that will lead to 100 jobs over the next couple of years. We're most grateful for the assistance and the effectiveness of OEDD programs. I would be glad to answer any questions.
Are there questions of Mr. Hare? Senator Tuca was recognized.
Mr. Hare, what
how would it sound be as opposed to a rural community if you had an opportunity to have a facility that would, some sort of investment that would create 500 jobs for the community, give an average income of about $41,000 of those 500 jobs, and the institution, it would be an institution that would last, all planned to be around for 100 years. Would that kind of opportunity sound like a good opportunity, do you think, for some rural communities?
I believe you're setting me up, Senator Cusa. I can tell you, Mr. Chair, Senator Cusa, that there are some communities that I think, some rural communities that would very much welcome that kind of an opportunity. I can tell you that in my own community in LeGrand, when that question was put on the ballot a number of years ago, specific to the institution you're talking about, it was rejected by a 3-1 margin. I think each community is different. They all have their own plans, their own goals, and I think that's why organizations like ODDA and RDI are so effective, is that they work very closely in the community to help sort of ferret out what the values are and the goals are and make those things happen.
I did something more recently than the last few years and found out that there were 11 communities in this state that voted on and sent resolutions of community interest. Actually, eight. Eight that actually voted on them. The others were letters that came from the community and from either the county commissioners or from the city council, that they were very interested. And by the way, committee, if you haven't guessed already, that is a prison facility. And it was really sad to have to turn down the communities that asked, because I travel to those communities, and some of them actually have the ability to handle it. Most of them had the ability actually to handle it, either with housing or whatever. I guess my question in relation to this, because I do know it is good. In fact, I've been told by economic development, those that try to bring in economic development to the community, that this is a project to die for. If you were able to provide this to your community, you have got it made in the shade. I mean, it's an answer for some communities to be able to sustain their community, particularly when a mill closes down and you have jobs lost and there are people that actually want to live where they are living and do that by having an opportunity for a facility such as a state prison. My question is, why do we not work a little more closely with economic development to bring about these kinds of things? Now, if we did it a few years ago, maybe we ought to go back to the drawing board and ask the question again, because more mills have closed down. Other things have happened in the last few years that actually I think has made it more attractive to other communities. And is this something that that there is some interest with economic development to seek out state projects that really could help a community to thrive?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cusa. I think, again, that there are communities around the state that would be very, very interested in having a state facility such as you described in their location. In Union County, where I'm from, we aggressively pursued a youth accountability camp and were successful in having that located. In fact, the city of LeGrand has dedicated $50,000 to making that project work, even though it's 20 miles outside our city. So we're very supportive of that type of facility. By contrast, Oak Ridge and Heppner, two communities that have both lost mills, are very desperate for economic development, both rejected, in Heppner's case, the Oregon Youth Authority facility that we're now having in Union County. They said they didn't want it, and their council actually had to overturn their original letter of support for that. In Oak Ridge, there was an adult work camp scheduled to be built there, and I believe the governor cited it there, and as I understand it, there was so much fear in the community, they canceled the plans to build. It's a very individual, community-by-community calculation, in my opinion.
follow-up questions for Mr. Hare.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hare, and we are going to be on the calls of the House and Senate very shortly. Appreciate that your testimony, and apologize for the interruption. We are out of time, and we will go ahead and plan to adjourn until tomorrow for the balance of the testimony. I'm not sure exactly what our agenda looks like tomorrow. Robin, do you feel, can we go ahead and finish up with the other issues relative to the ODDA community assistance and then the regional investment funds, because we did not get to the court to finalize the court issues.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we can do that. I'm not sure how many people that were scheduled to testify can return, but I'll work with Mr. Scott on that.
Okay. We did have four additions that came up, and I apologize. There's still two just one that did not get David Vandrup, and then Mr. Mike Thorne that we have added subsequently. So we'll plan to go ahead and adjourn until tomorrow at even time, 8 o'clock. Promoted. Thank you very much. Thank you.